Marie had accompanied her husband to Chicago, but avoided the banquet. She rejoined him at the hotel, and they drove together to Chicago Heights. A wrong turn sent them into an unfamiliar South Side neighborhood, and they wandered around for more than an hour before regaining their bearings, sniping at each other all the while. It was part of their routine, Vin and Ree. They could hardly go anywhere in the car without fighting. By the time they reached Susan's apartment, the twins were asleep in a bassinet. Vince was awed by the sight and stood above them whispering, "One baby, two babies." The miracle of birth compounded. He wanted to hold them, but Marie insisted that he not wake them up. So after a brief time chatting on the couch, he started fidgeting. They couldn't stay the night. From Susan's, they were heading to the airport and back to Washington. Marie could sense her husband's discomfort. "You know something, Vin? Why don't you take Susan to the store and buy her some groceries?" she suggested. He jumped at the idea, and soon Susan and her father were strolling down the aisles of her local supermarket. It was as though Lombardi was on a game show, where he had 5 minutes to throw as much as he could into the shopping cart. The more exotic, the better, as far as he was concerned. Caviar, canned hams and chickens, anchovies, brie, delicate crackers, all piling up in the cart as he moved down the gourmet row, then onto the baby formula section. "Here's a case. That enough?" He was reading labels, but no price was too steep. Susan couldn't help laughing. Her dad let loose in a grocery, showering her with gifts for this one brief moment, as though each little package could make up for a week spent without her. It wasn't that he had to buy her love. The love was there, but time was not. He rang up a bill of more than $200. "And in 1970, that was a lot of money," Susan said. When they got back to the apartment, the prospect of lugging all those bags up the stairs was too daunting for him, so he found two neighborhood boys and paid them with a dollar and his autograph. They betrayed no hint of knowing who he was. Patriotism and golf occupied most of Lombardi's time in early June. He'd been asked by J. Willard Marriott to serve as honorary vice chairman of an Honor America Day program scheduled for July 4th, and accepted enthusiastically. When skeptical journalists asked if he was being used by the Nixon administration, he noted that former presidents Johnson and Truman were also on the committee, as well as AFL-CIO chief George Meany. "This is not pro-administration, not pro-Nixon, not pro-anything except one thing, America," he said. "We'd like to show the world, and maybe a lot of our own people, that we are Americans, and we are proud of what we have here." Gordon Peterson, a local television and radio reporter, visited Lombardi at his Connecticut Avenue office to conduct an interview on Honor America Day. Peterson said that he'd come in prepared to shrink the legend, expecting to be disappointed by Lombardi, but came away taken by him. Some of his rhetoric could sound harsh, Peterson said later, but in person he seemed very open-minded, more so than I expected him to be. The protests were raging, and he said these people have a constitutional right to protest, but that the country had been very good to him, and he said the racial thing is a disgrace. He said that very forcefully. Lombardi had acquired a new group of golfing partners in Washington. He played several courses, including Burning Tree and the Army-Navy Club, but most of his rounds were at Congressional Country Club in Potomac. One of his frequent partners there was Ralph Guglielmi, a former quarterback at Notre Dame, preceding Hornung, who played 9 seasons in the NFL. They played for $2 Nassaus, which Lombardi fought to win with the same determination he would put into a Super Bowl. During one round, Guglielmi told Lombardi that a friend of his in the computer business in Dayton had asked whether he could persuade the coach to come out to Ohio in mid-June for a speech to salesmen. God damn it, Ralph. That's the time I'm having camp, Lombardi said. You ought to know better than asking me then. Guglielmi said he'd already told his friend that there was not much chance of it, but that he had to ask. A few days later, Lombardi called Guglielmi. "What about that thing out there, the banquet?" he began. "Would it help you out any if I did it?" That was the generous side of Lombardi. He had felt guilty about not helping a friend. "Tell them I want 5,000, and you come with me, and you get 1,500," he went on. "You emcee the ceremonies. I don't want any stranger introducing me." Guglielmi readily consented. Lombardi had felt tired and constipated for several days before the trip. In preparation for the season, he'd tried running up the hill behind his Stanmore drive home, and the simple exercise exhausted him. He went to Dayton nonetheless, catching a plane with Guglielmi late on the Sunday afternoon of June 21st. They arrived in time to have dinner at an Italian restaurant, and by Guglielmi's account, Lombardi ordered a huge meal. The sales seminar, sponsored by the SCM Allied Agri Company, was held the next afternoon. Guglielmi did his job, making the introductions, then sat dumbstruck as Lombardi took the podium and began by announcing that both he and Ralph would donate their honoraria to the local boys' club. "I say to myself, you son of a bitch," Guglielmi recalled. Then he sat spellbound with the rest of the audience as the coach gave them the full Lombardi, all 7 blocks of his standard speech. Football, competition, perfection, authority, discipline, leadership, and character. He even had a new introduction explaining what he meant by the well-known phrase, "Winning isn't everything, it's the only thing." "You know, being part of a football team is no different than being part of any other organization. Being a part of any army, being a part of a political party. The objective is to win. The objective is to beat the other guy. Some may think this is a little bit hard and a little bit cruel. I don't think so. I do think that is the reality of life. I do think that men are competitive, and the more competitive the business, the more competitive the men. They know the rules when they get into the game. They know the objective when they get into the game. And the objective is to win. Fairly, squarely, decently. Win by the rules, but still win. In truth, gentlemen, I've never really known a successful man who deep in his heart did not appreciate the discipline it takes to win." When the speech was over, Lombardi received a standing ovation, then fielded questions, most of which, to his apparent relief, were about football. He said that Bart Starr was the greatest quarterback he'd ever seen, but that Sonny Jurgensen was a better athlete. "Jurgensen is so important in my plans that if he were to leave, I'd follow him the next morning." He dismissed Kansas City coach Hank Stram's claim that the era of rollout quarterbacks was coming. Quarterbacks were too special to be endangered that way, he said. In fact, Lombardi insisted, there were no new trends in football that impressed him. "If there were, I'd put him in." In taking the last question, Lombardi said that this would be his final non-football speech of the year. "There are 365 days in a year, and I get at least 500 invitations to speak," he said. "I don't take many, but I think this will be all." At the hotel late that night, Lombardi placed a call to Guglielmi's room. "Come on down, Ralph," he said. "I'm having some problems I have to talk to you about." When Lombardi opened the door, Guglielmi could see that he was in pain. "He said, I haven't taken a crap in 3 days," Guglielmi later recalled. "I said, well, that's not normal, coach, but you've been kind of on the go a bit. You had a big meal last night. Maybe you're just constipated. And he said, "Can you go out and get me a fleet enema?" I said, "I don't know, coach. It's at 11 at night, but I'll try." Guglielmi went down to the front desk, learned the location of a late-night pharmacy, called a cab, and returned to Lombardi's room with three fleet enemas. The next morning at breakfast, Lombardi said he didn't feel like eating. Did the enemas work? No, he said. He'd ended up taking all three of them, but no luck. The flight to Washington was to leave shortly after noon. Lombardi and Guglielmi reached the terminal just as an airport bar was opening. He says, "I want to stop in here," Guglielmi recalled. So we stop. A waitress comes over. Lombardi says, "Give me a double vodka on the rocks, please. You want anything, Ralph?" I get a glass of tomato juice. Now he gets one, two, three double vodkas. "It's too early to drink," I'm thinking. Lombardi isn't an imbiber. He likes a scotch or two. I don't know why he's doing this, but you don't question the coach. When we get back to the airport, his driver is there to pick him up and take him home. The next thing I know, he's in the hospital. Georgetown University Hospital. Admission date, June 24, 1970. Time, 2:30 p.m. Name, Lombardi, Vincent T. Room number, 6316. Rate, $80. Occupation, football coach. He returned from Dayton on the 23rd and was in the hospital by the next afternoon. In between, he had told Dr. Resta, the Redskins' team physician, that he'd been unable to defecate for several days, and Resta sent him to Georgetown after a barium enema revealed a lesion in his left colon. Marie was in the room with her husband when he received his first visitor, Father Edward Bunn, S.J., Georgetown's chancellor. The two men had known each other for more than three decades, since Lombardi was an undergraduate at Fordham, and Bunn was a professor there who taught him philosophy and psychology. "You know, Father, I've never been in a hospital before in my life," Lombardi said, discounting the weeks he spent in the Fordham infirmary after a football injury. "I didn't even bring any extra clothes with me." Father Bunn said he would pray for him and began a daily vigil at his old student's bedside. Later that afternoon, Dr. Robert Coffey, a specialist in colon surgery, conducted a preliminary examination that found Lombardi in no distress. His prostate was slightly enlarged, according to the medical report, and he had tenderness and fullness in his lower left abdomen, a small internal hemorrhoid, but no rectal mass. But further tests the next morning brought grim news. The biopsy from a proctoscopy revealed anaplastic carcinoma in the rectal area of his colon, a fast-growing malignant cancer in which the cells barely resemble their normal appearance. Marie had suspected it long before anyone else, and had confessed to a haunting fear that he had cancer in the letter she had written to Vincent the previous November. Now here was the reality. She tried to keep the news from some people. When she called Susan in Chicago Heights, it was only to say that he was in the hospital. But there was nothing much to worry about. It might be a hernia. She passed along the same message to Vince's parents in Sheepshead Bay. Afraid that the truth might kill Harry, the tough old 5x5 who'd plugged on past several heart attacks but might not survive bad news about his oldest son. Vincent had been on vacation with his family in Wisconsin that week and discovered that his father was in the hospital from a news report while watching television in their motel room. He immediately called his mother, who said she had been frantically looking for him. Why? He wondered. The report made it sound as if his father had the flu. "It's worse than that," Marie told him. "You better come on out." Exploratory abdominal surgery was performed on Lombardi at 8:30 on that Saturday morning, June 27th. During a 2-hour and 15-minute operation, a team of surgeons led by Dr. Coffey removed a 2-foot section of the rectosigmoid colon, the part of the colon closest to the rectum where they had discovered a polypoid tumor. Tests revealed that the tumor was malignant, just as the earlier biopsy had indicated. But at Marie's request, when Dr. Coffey met the press later that day, he left the opposite impression. He said that preliminary findings indicated the tumor was non-malignant. They wouldn't know for certain until tests came back in 4 days, he said, but most similar tumors turned out to be benign. Decades later, this sort of deception would be rare and controversial, but at the time, it was common and accepted. Edward Bennett Williams continued the public deception, telling reporters that Lombardi's prognosis appeared excellent and that he would resume normal activities within 4 weeks. While Williams and Marie both knew that Lombardi's condition was worse than the public diagnosis, they did have some reason to hope for the best. The doctors had told them that the cancer had not spread to the liver or lymph nodes. Losing part of his colon couldn't stop Lombardi, Williams told friends. Vince has so much guts they could take out 50 feet, and he'd still have more than the rest of us. 4 days after the operation, a hospital spokesman said there would be no update on Lombardi's condition. The test results were in, but they would not be made public. Members of Lombardi's family have instructed us that they have given out all the information they want released on the case, the spokesman said. This inevitably created an air of mystery around the ailing coach. The Honor America Day celebration on July 4th came and went, with Lombardi still in the hospital. On July 6th, he missed his annual golf outing with the sporting press, this one held at Congressional. Williams was there, pounded with questions about who would run the Redskins training camp when it opened in 2 weeks. Would there be an interim coach? Williams offered an even more optimistic timetable than his earlier back-in-4 weeks prediction, now insisting that Lombardi would return in time for the first day of camp, July 19th. On the day Williams made that optimistic statement, Lombardi's temperature spiked to 102 because of an infection in his surgical incision. But it appeared to be only a minor setback. By July 10th, he was ready for release. The wound was considered healed and strong, and his temperature was back to normal. He was sent home with instructions to follow a low-residue diet and to take Darvon and chloral hydrate for pain and sleep. "At that point," said Vincent, "we thought the prospects seemed good."
"Away with anything."
The wound was considered healed and strong, and his temperature was back to normal. He was sent home with instructions to follow a low-residue diet and to take Darvon and chloral hydrate for pain and sleep. "At that point," said Vincent, "we thought the prospects seemed good." Back at home, Lombardi felt alternately restless and fatigued. He was supposed to be recuperating, but he seemed to be losing weight and strength every day. His brother Joe came down to stay that first weekend. For all of Joe's life, Vince had been the quintessential older brother, dictating, demanding, expecting, challenging. Now he seemed helpless. "I remember tying his shoelaces for him," Joe said later. "He would sit on a bed, and I would go up and tie his shoes. Then we'd go for a walk around the property a little bit, and he'd talk." They discussed everything: wives, children, regrets, and the Washington Redskins. "I have a big job to do here," Vince said, listing what it would take to lift the Redskins up to a championship-caliber team. But Joe thought Vince knew he would never get that chance. "It was never said, but I got that feeling." His outlook seemed to change depending on the day or the company he was with. When Wellington and Ann Mara came down from New York for a 2-day visit, Lombardi was tired but optimistic. He had to excuse himself after dinner to rest, but he also told Mara with a determined voice that he intended to go to training camp. "I'm gonna beat this," he said. He and Marie drove downtown for lunch at Duke's with Ed Williams and Ben Bradley, and if Lombardi was strong enough to get in a spat with Marie and tell her to shut up, part of their routine patter, he showed little other energy. He was very quiet, Bradley recalled. I remember him appearing to be uncomfortable and not well. The next visitor at Stanmore Drive was Jack Kepler, who came out from Green Bay with his son Kevin. Kepler's first impression was that his old friend looked smaller. His face had gotten smaller. At one point, Marie took Kevin to the trophy room in the basement to show him Vince's mementos, and after they had left the room, Lombardi told Kepler that he was dying. I said, "Ah, you fought through a lot worse?" And he said, "No, I know I'm dying." I asked, "How do you know?" And he said there were three doctors working on him, and he found the weakest of the three and asked him how soon it would be before he could resume coaching. And the guy says, "I don't think you'll be coaching again." Vince knew. He knew. As concerned as Lombardi was about his health, he was also troubled by the game he loved. For the second time in 3 years, the preseason was being delayed by a confrontation between players and owners over salary and pension issues. The NFL and AFL Players Associations had merged that year under the leadership of a new executive director, Ed Garvey. When the players threatened to strike, management preempted them by locking them out, opening the camps only to rookies. The day before Redskins camp was to open, Lombardi summoned his coaching staff out to Stanmore Drive. It was clear that he would not make it to Carlisle then, if ever. "Well, boys, Bill's going to run training camp," he said, referring to Bill Austin. "He's been with me the longest. He knows how to run it. Operate for him as you would for me." He never uttered the word cancer, but as they were all leaving, he said obliquely, "You can all make your own opinion about this." The labor dispute infuriated him so much that he decided to travel to New York on July 21st, for a meeting of NFL club owners. Marie was worried about his fragile health and tried to talk him out of it, as did Dr. Coffey, but Lombardi was insistent. Marie ended up accompanying him on the trip and asked Joe to meet them at the airport and drive them to the Midtown session. It all jumbled together for Lombardi now. Long hair, rebellion, student protests, anarchy, unions, strikes. All of it to him reflected what Father Cox had been talking about back at Fordham a third of a century earlier, the abuse of freedom. The only answer was to be fair but firm, he told the owners. He didn't believe in football strikes, but he hated the idea of opening up camps to veterans who might cross the picket line, an act that he insisted would destroy team unity. He was equally repulsed by the notion of giving in to the union. It was up to the owners, he said, to maintain the structure and the discipline of pro football. "Gentlemen, you must not give away your game to a bunch of 22-year-old kids." Redskins aide David Slattery entered the room as Lombardi was speaking those lines. His voice was almost a whisper. He was fading out on them, and I think he finished before he intended to, Slattery said. He looked absolutely terrible, like death warmed over. He told me he had to get back to Washington immediately. The trip home was a disaster. On the ride to the airport, Lombardi became dizzy, and his heart started beating rapidly. Marie was afraid that he was having a heart attack. It was later diagnosed as paroxysmal atrial tachycardia, an arrhythmia caused when the heartbeat begins at an abnormal place. They were in a taxi, with no one to help them. Marie lugged their two bags through the terminal, her husband leaning on her as they walked. There was a long line at the ticket counter. She pleaded with the airline's clerk to let Vin on the plane ahead of everyone else so that he could relax, but she was rebuffed. The stewardesses seemed rude, unconcerned with her plight. Marie got to her seat and started crying. When they arrived at Washington National, Lombardi was struggling to carry his own bag when a nice young man asked if he could help. Vin never would ask for help, Marie said later. But this time he said, "Help me, please." I almost cried right there. When he got home, doctors treated his rapid heartbeat with digitalis. The next day, he asked Leroy Washington, the chauffeur he shared with Ed Williams, to drive him to Georgetown, not to re-enter the hospital, but to watch his veteran players who were working out on their own at Kehoe Field. These were his boys. Even if he didn't like them as a union, he loved them as individuals and as a team. And there they were, paying silent tribute to the old man by going through his conditioning drills, even without him hovering over them, and driving them to do more, push harder, get those feet moving. Pat Richter, the player representative, was leading the grass drills when he looked up and saw in the distance a frail figure struggling to get out of a black sedan. Who was that man now leaning against the car? "My God," Richter said to himself. "That's Coach Lombardi." There was a game the next day, the Redskins rookies against the Colts rookies at Memorial Stadium in Baltimore. Lombardi couldn't stay away and sat in the owner's enclosure with Marie and Edward Bennett Williams. He visited the locker room after the game, shuffling slowly amid the players, offering quiet words of encouragement. Just standing there for a few minutes tired him out, so he found a training table and leaned against it. George Dixon approached him looking for a scouting report. "Coach, anything you want to tell me about the running backs?" Lombardi was a shadow of his old self, but his football mind was still keen. He stared at Dixon and said bluntly, "You haven't got any running backs." On July 27th, exactly 1 month from the day of his first operation, Lombardi was readmitted to Georgetown and immediately sent back into surgery. His pre-operation symptoms pointed to trouble. He hadn't had a bowel movement in 3 days, and an X-ray showed a partial bowel obstruction. This time, the exploratory surgery found that the cancer had spread massively to his liver, peritoneum, and lymph nodes. Dr. Coffey was stunned, calling it one of the most voracious cancers he'd ever seen. There was nothing they could do except sew him back up, bombard him with cobalt, irradiation, and chemotherapy, and pray. He was a terminal case. Aki Kruger would never forget Marie's wail of despair when Dr. Coffey delivered the fatal prognosis. Again, there was no public announcement of his condition. He was said to be resting comfortably, but beyond that, at the family's request, there would be no comment. His fatal condition was an open secret among journalists in Washington, yet it was never reported. The most famous coach in America, the head coach of the local pro football team, was dying in a nearby hospital, and not one word of it in the newspapers or on the airwaves. "It was getting more and more rampant around town that he was dying," said Marty Zad, sports editor at the Post. But those were still the days when the media would respect the wishes of family and friends and self-censor the news. The cobalt irradiation began on July 30th, blasting away at his entire abdomen. That same day, when he was wheeled back to his room, Lombardi noticed a large bouquet of flowers. The card read, "You are a great coach and a great individual to all of us." "Look at those flowers in the corner," Lombardi said later to Aki Kruger. "Now look at who they're from." The card was signed by the National Football League Players Association. Lombardi could lambaste the union all he wanted. The players still loved him. In absentia, in fact, he had been crucial to their solidarity that year. At a key meeting in Chicago, several big-name players were talking about bailing out of the strike and going back to camp. And it was Bart Starr, one of the most conservative members of the group, who put a stop to it, and he did it by evoking Lombardi. "I just want to say that 2 years ago, Coach Lombardi called me in and said, 'I don't like unions and I sure don't like players' associations, but if I were quarterback of the Packers, I'd sure as hell be a leader of the union,' Starr said. The message was that Lombardi had taught Starr the meaning of teamwork and loyalty. Starr became sort of a legend from that speech, said Ed Garvey, the NFLPA director. Added Pat Richter of the Redskins. That's one great thing Coach Lombardi preached, singleness of purpose. He wants to keep a whole team together. The coach was fading, and priests, nuns, and football players streamed up to the sixth floor and waited in Marie's side room for permission to see him on his deathbed. Boxes of letters came in, 500 a day, and more flowers than Marie could find room for. Lombardi seemed haunted, embarrassed by his helpless condition, a relentlessly proud man whose body was giving up, 40 pounds lost already in the struggle against cancer. IVs in his arm. A Cantor tube, leading out through his nose, evicted a copious flow of dry blood and gastric juices. His heart was beating too rapidly. His blood pressure was dropping. His face was so gaunt that he might have been unrecognizable, if not for his top front row of teeth, appearing larger than ever within his shrinking face, taking their gaps from left to right like Skoronsky, Thurston, Ringo, Kramer, and Greg at the line of scrimmage. His fingers, long, fleshy digits that were unforgettable to anybody who had ever been on the other side of one of his pointed lectures, now looked bent and withdrawn. The only part of him growing along with his cancer was his hair, despite the radiation treatment, untrimmed and free at last, as if to mock the myth of the old man. He had cut his hair every week of his life. "Vinna long hair, that's beautiful," said his wife. Even his eyebrows were growing wild. Father Bunn stopped by every day praying for a miracle. Father McPartland drove down from New Jersey and gave his old coach a blessing. Little Joe made Washington a twice-weekly stop on his sales rounds for Rawlings and stopped by room 6100 so often that Lombardi gave him a double take once, and tough big brother to the last muttered sternly, "Don't you ever work?" Ed Williams came by every day and often left crying. Wellington Mara called Lombardi every afternoon at 2, right before he went out for the Giants practice. When he forgot one day, Lombardi groused, "What the hell's the matter with Well?" Howard Cosell and Toots Shore rang up Marie at night, seeking medical updates. Jackie Anderson devoted herself to Marie, spending her days in the waiting room and nights in the large and lonely house in Potomac Falls. Marie virtually lived at the hospital, drinking endless cups of black coffee and chain-smoking Salems as she accepted condolences and directed traffic in and out of her husband's room. His boys make the pilgrimage in August. Frank Gifford leans over the bed, feeling an urge to kiss him, thinking about the pasta dinners in New Jersey, hearing Vinny tell him, "God, Frank, it hurts." In comes Bill Curry, played center for the Packers for 2 years, left hating the old man, now realizing that he resented him because he forced him to grow when he didn't want to, and he tries to explain that change of heart, and the coach looks up at him and says, "If you want to help me, Bill, pray for me." Chuck Mersane, hero of the Ice Bowl, comes in, doesn't know what to say, and leaves crying. Sonny Jurgensen stops by, and the coach is briefly alert, has a new idea for a pass play against the 3-4 defense, a way to fool the weak side linebacker. It's got to work. Willie Davis makes the red-eye flight from San Diego. He had played for great coaches all his career, first Eddie Robinson at Grambling, and then Paul Brown at Cleveland. But it was Lombardi, he says, who changed his life. He walks into the room and sees a ghost of his old coach and says, "If you'll come back to Green Bay, I'll come out of retirement." And Lombardi growls, "You're a hell of a man, Willie. Now get out of here." In for maybe a minute and a half, and even now, he does what the coach says and leaves. Willie Wood is working in his hometown that summer. He thinks he owes his career to Lombardi, a black quarterback, undrafted out of USC, but the old man was all merit, straight down the line, and gave me a chance. He thinks he will visit Lombardi in the hospital every week, but after one visit, leaves so distraught that he cannot return, saying he doesn't want to remember coach like that. Jimmy Taylor, the roughneck fullback who had played out his option and jilted Green Bay for New Orleans in 1966, surprises Marie by showing up. She accompanies him into the room, and Vince takes his hand and holds it, for such a long time. Jerry Kramer, working on a book of recollections, visits the hospital on August 4th, arriving as the coach is being brought back from cobalt treatment. Lombardi is tired and apologizes to his old right guard, saying they'll have to wait for another time to do an interview until I get this thing licked. Fuzzy Thurston and Bob Skoronski show up together and chat with Marie first. They can see that she is losing the only thing she had in her life, and after a while they ask if they can go in to see the coach. When they enter his room, he reaches out a feeble hand and they both grab it. His eyes start to flutter, and the nurse says they'd better leave. Paul is here, Marie tells Vince, and his eyes light up. The golden boy walks in alone. He looks at Lombardi, but can't think of what to say, and leaves, regretting that he cannot find the words to convey how much the old man means to him. Lombardi already knows. Hornung found the words once before and put them in a letter he wrote on February 23, 1967, as he was leaving Green Bay for New Orleans. I want you to know that I have always felt closer to you than any coach I have ever had or ever hoped to have. I believe the greatest thing I've learned from your football has not only been the idea of winning, but why you want to win. Each and every ball player who's had the opportunity of playing under your guidance in some ways will always try to mirror some part of your personality. The prodigal son is followed by the good son, Bart Starr, who comes in with Zeke Bratkowski and has the same experience, all words inadequate. A minute or two and they're out of the room, riding back to the airport in the back of a taxi, silent. On August 8th, the Redskins played the Bengals in Cincinnati. Marie watched the game in Vince's room. He seemed lively at first, chewing out players as though he were down on the field. When Marie told him that Charlie Taylor dropped a pass, he growled, "I can see." But he was exhausted before halftime, and when Marie noticed that he'd fallen asleep, she turned off the television and left him alone. Curtis Wilkie, a young journalist, was staying on the same floor, recovering from gallbladder surgery. He looked across the hall when the sportscasters declared that Vince Lombardi was watching the game in his hospital room. "Not really, not anymore," Wilkie noticed. Lombardi's room was dark and silent. Everyone in Washington now knew Lombardi was dying. President Nixon called on the night of August 11th, wishing him well and saying that the whole country was rooting for him. "You are very kind," Lombardi said. "What you have said is very flattering." Both houses of Congress took time out to praise him 2 days later. "Mr. President," said Senator William Proxmire of Wisconsin, "a remarkable man lies ill." "In a sense," said Representative Hugh Carey of New York, "he is the coach of our generation." Lombardi was being eulogized before his death. The word of his condition had finally reached Harry and Mattie in Sheepshead Bay, despite Marie's efforts to keep it from them, and one of Vince's Izzo cousins drove them down to Washington, where they stayed for 2 days, preparing for the blow that was soon to come. Susan also paid a visit, and though Marie warned her beforehand about how much her father had changed, the sight still shocked her. "It just wasn't my father lying in that bed," she said. He was strong enough to talk and asked about his grandchildren. And as Susan was leaving, he turned to Marie and said, "Well, I guess everything is going to be fine." By the 20th, his white blood cell count had dropped to 2,100. He was having continuous heart palpitations. He began to have periods of disorientation. One night, as Marie sat nearby in the stillness of the room, he startled her by barking out a stern warning in his sleep. "Joe Namath," he shouted. "You're not bigger than football. Remember that." Lombardi respected Namath's talent. Before the opening kickoff of the 1969 Super Bowl, he had seconded the white-shoed quarterback's bold prediction that the insurgent Jets would upset the Baltimore Colts. But Namath, a relatively tame character compared with what was to follow, nonetheless might have evoked something deeply troubling to the old man. It was as though, in his dying vision, he saw Michael Irvin and Brian Bosworth and Deion Sanders coming along behind Broadway Joe. Marie told friends that she thought she understood what her husband was expressing in his semi-conscious state. As difficult as it was for her to accept the fact that he was dying, she tried to console herself with the idea that perhaps he was meant to die now because the world was changing in ways that he could not accept. He loved the players above all else, yet circumstances might force him to turn away from them, as his sleep-talking warning to Joe Namath suggested. She predicted that he would plead with the owners to hold the line, but that they would be incapable of doing so, and the players would end up with too much freedom, tearing away at the order that held his world together and destroying his concept of team. In the end, Marie told friends, I think football will break his heart. It could be argued that Lombardi was dying at the appropriate time. He was in danger of being reduced to a convenient symbol by then, his philosophy misused by all sides in the political debates of that war-torn era. The establishment had turned him to stone even while he was alive, hoisting him up as a monument to righteousness, patriotism, and free enterprise. Counterculturalists smashed him as a relic of old-line authoritarianism and a dangerous, win-at-all-costs philosophy. Both were wrong. He was more complicated, his philosophy more authentic than either side could then appreciate. But if he had lived for another 2 decades, he might have faced more frustrations. The age of skepticism was coming with Watergate, combining with a long era celebrating the self. Lombardi was meant for none of that, and leaving the scene was a way for him to survive in memory as a mythic symbol, the block of granite and steadfast coach of the glorious Packers. Rather than staying around to become an increasingly frustrated coach fighting for relevance in the fickle modern American culture. Lombardi might have disagreed with that line of thinking. I'm not afraid to die, he told Father Tim Moore one day in the hospital room, but there's so much yet to be done in the world. Vincent visited his father's hospital room several times that month, coming from his home in St. Paul. He was 28, and for all of his life he and his father had never talked much. How many times had they driven to the stadium and back in silence? It was the same now. No deathbed reconciliation, at least not a verbal one. My dad and I never made conversations, so this wasn't much different, Vincent said later. I was just there. He would not blame his father for this, and in time would blame himself. There were things that could have been said that were not said. The time never seemed quite right. But we were getting there. I think you had to grow to my dad's level. Having kids and graduating from law school helped. I was getting there. There was one expression of love between father and son in those final days. Vince was strapped to tubes, his hair mussed and wild, and in came Vincent, short sideburns, hair neatly trimmed, wearing a conservative business suit. The old man smiled with approval. You look like a lawyer, he said. By August 31st, Lombardi was slipping in and out of consciousness, but he remembered that this was a special day, their 30th wedding anniversary. Happy anniversary, Ree, he said to Marie. Remember, I love you. Earlier in the month, when he was more coherent, he had tried to start a conversation with Marie about what she should do when he died. I don't want to talk about it, she had said. Now it was too late. On September 1st, his liver and kidneys started to fail, clots formed in his lungs, his blood pressure dropped, and he became unresponsive. His organs were shutting down. Vincent was called again to come out from St. Paul, and Aki Kruger arranged tickets for Susan and Paul to fly in from Chicago on United. The doctor suggested to Marie that she should stay by her husband overnight. The loyal communicant received last rites. The press was finally alerted to his condition. On September 2nd, the Post ran a small item saying that Lombardi was near death. Hours later, a hospital spokesman announced that Lombardi had an extraordinarily virulent form of cancer. Vincent and Marie took turns napping and sitting by his side. At 7:20 on the morning of September 3rd, a nurse shook Vincent awake and told him that his father had died. Paul Hornung, who happened to be in nearby College Park, where he was to open a restaurant later that day, was jolted awake with an odd sensation. "It was freaky," he said later. "I woke up and said to myself, 'We lost him, we lost him.'" Tom Brown, who was in Minnesota trying out for the Vikings, bolted out of bed at the same moment with a similar foreboding. "I looked at the clock, and it was 6:30, and all I could think of was Lombardi. Just Lombardi, that's all I could see." Susan was still packing her bags at her apartment, getting ready to leave for the airport. She zipped her suitcase and took it to the car, then said that she'd forgotten something and went back inside. The phone rang, and it was her mother telling her that her father had died. "I passed out, fainted. Paul picks me up from the floor. My father-in-law is there. They're shoving me out the door because now I can't miss the flight. Get to the airport and Paul is guiding me. I'm totally lost. My father has died. We get on the plane and the stewardess comes down the aisle and says, 'Mr. and Mrs. Bickham, the captain would like to move you to first class. We have two seats up there for you.' The captain comes out of the cockpit and tells me how sorry he is that my father has died. My father flew United with the Packers for all those years. We get to Washington and they let me and Paul off first, and my father's limousine is waiting for us with my brother and Leroy Washington, and we drive out to the house, and I'm just dazed. We get there, and my mother is in another world." Marie called her friend, Jackie Anderson, and asked her to come over to Stanmore Drive. They left the family inside and went out to the patio, where Marie collapsed into a chair. "I don't know what I'm going to do," she said. "I can't go on." Vincent and Aki Kruger and old Fordham friends in New York began making all the calls and the arrangements. There were viewings at Joseph Gawler's son's funeral home in Washington and the Abbey funeral home in New York. Open casket for the family only, the closed casket viewed by thousands of strangers. Young men with long hair, blacks in high afros, nuns in black drape, boys in uniform carrying helmets and footballs. 4 days after his death, at 10, on the morning of Labor Day, September 7th, the funeral was held at St. Patrick's Cathedral. There was an unfamiliar silence in Midtown Manhattan that holiday morning. Not the normal blare and pound of taxi horns and construction drills. Fifth Avenue, between 50th and 39th Streets, was closed to traffic. A late summer sun heated thousands of onlookers who stood somberly behind the police barricades across the avenue from the cathedral. On a side street, a long fleet of black limousines waited to ferry family and friends to the burial site at Mount Olivet Cemetery in Middletown Township, New Jersey, not far from the Lombardi's old home in Fairhaven. The casket was shouldered up the steps through a cordon of priests in white vestments and dark-suited honorary pallbearers, including Paul Hornung, Bart Starr, and Willie Davis, Wellington Mara, Tony Canadeo, Dick Borgannon, and Edward Bennett Williams. Marie, in black dress and veil, took a seat up front with Vincent and Susan. Nearby were Harry and Mattie and brothers Joe and Harold and sisters Madeline and Claire, protected by scores of Izzos. Cousin Anthony Izzo thought of all the years that had led up to this moment, all the games they had gone to see at the Polo Grounds and Yankee Stadium and Mitchie Stadium up at West Point, all of the honor that Cousin Vince had brought the family. And now, it's all over. To the side sat the team owners and Commissioner Roselle, who 3 days later would name the Super Bowl trophy after Lombardi. And behind them were row upon row of square-cut football players. The entire Packers squad flew out on a chartered flight from Green Bay. The Redskins came from Tampa, where they were playing an exhibition game. Most of the New York Giants were there. Retired Packers from the title years came on their own, as did former students from Saints, colleagues from the Giants and West Point, and classmates from Fordham, including the remaining blocks of granite. Vincent was called to the podium to read from Scripture to honor his father. Dave Robinson, the Packers linebacker, had lost his own father when he was young, and witnessing this seemed almost as traumatic. The tears started rolling down his cheeks. It was, he said, meaning it not as a sign of race consciousness, but as honest feeling, the only time he ever cried at the funeral of a white man. Bob Skowronski, seated nearby, had the speeches of Lombardi resounding in his head and realized that he would hear the coach's voice for the rest of his life. Terence Cardinal Cook delivered the eulogy, basing his homily on the epistles of St. Paul. He knew that Lombardi was drawn to St. Paul because it was not uncommon for St. Paul, faced with the mysteries of life and death and eternal life, to describe them in terms of an athletic contest, with victory or defeat as the outcome, and with a prize as the reward for the victors. It was St. Paul, in his letter to the Corinthians, who'd given Coach Lombardi his favorite quote from Scripture, the one he kept repeating to his Packers during their final drive to football greatness in 1967, the saying that hung, framed, and illuminated on the wall of his den back home. Brethren, don't you know that while all the runners in the stadium take part in the race, only one wins the prize? Run to win. Epilogue.
Winning is not a sometime thing. It's an all-the-time thing, Vince Lombardi often said, and his wife believed it.
Marie believed almost all of his maxims, at least as much as he did. Believing in the coach was a matter of survival for her, even now that he was long dead. That explains why she was following his advice here in the solitude of her Oceanside condominium and practicing a speech until she got it right. "Oh, yech," she said to herself with smoky disdain. She turned the tape recorder off again. This was her third rehearsal. It had gone smoothly until the end, when she momentarily lost her train of thought. If she wanted to do it right when it counted, at the NFL Hall of Fame in Canton, she had to perfect it here first. This one was important to her. The introduction of Jimmy Taylor, the roughneck fullback, first of their boys, the Green Bay Packers of the 1960s, to be immortalized in bronze alongside her husband. She searched for descriptive words and memories, revising and reciting over and over again. She even used that refrain in the speech, quoting her husband, "You do what you do best, again and again and again." She turned the tape recorder on for another take. "Thank you. This is my third trip to what is known as football's greatest weekend. I'm thrilled and I'm honored to be here. About 6 weeks ago, I wasn't certain that I was going to be here because I was in the hospital having a nerve block on my face. And it's a terrible thing because it numbs one whole side of your face. And your mouth doesn't work too well. What's worse for a woman than your mouth doesn't work? If I seem nervous, or if I seem to slur my words a little bit, please bear with me. Now, this thing shattered me pretty badly, and I wasn't sure I could be here as much as I really wanted to do this for Jimmy. So I called my son in Seattle and said, 'Vincent, you better call Jimmy and tell him I can't go to Canton because I can't speak.' And he said, 'All right, Mother, if that's what you want.' An hour later, I called him back and I said, 'Don't call Jimmy, because a big voice up there said to me, "You better be in Canton and you better do a good job." So here I am, and I better do a good job, because if I don't, he'll probably trade me. And I suspect that I am pinch-hitting for that Italian with the big voice who can't be here. So I'll try to do a good job." This was the summer of 1976, 6 years after his death, and the Italian with the big voice was still telling Marie Lombardi what to do. It seemed that she lived in another world. Her penthouse suite occupied the top floor of a three-story condo on Ocean Boulevard and Manalapan, just south of Palm Beach. The decor was Florida Provincial, white on white, with splotches of color provided by her needlepoints. Looking out the sliding glass door from her living room, she watched cruise ships ease past and storms amass at sea. From the picture window of her back bedroom, facing west, she followed luxury yachts and cabin cruisers up and down the intercoastal waterway. Within easy reach were the exclusive shops of Worth Avenue, and she made a habit of strolling there. In almost every shop, the clerks knew her name. Although it had become more difficult for her recently because of illness and depression, she still attended the local charity balls and found her picture in the shiny sheet, Palm Beach's celebrity paper. People thought she wanted to go out and that she hungered for publicity. She certainly seemed to long for the reflected fame that had been hers back in the days when she entered restaurants at the side of the dominant figure in pro football. But her daily outings and frequent visits from friends and relatives seemed to be diversions from her single great preoccupation. Lombardi was dead, and she wasn't sure that left her with much reason to live. She retreated into what her family called her dream world, ushered into this ethereal realm by alcohol, pills, endless cups of coffee, black with sugar, at least one lighted Salem, often two going at once. Cigarettes were her best friends, she said, the room enshrouded in smoke, her ashtray looking like a sea anemone with its jumble of red lipstick-smeared butts. She sat there and let memories wash over her. With few appointments to keep, she set her clocks and watches on Lombardi time, 10 minutes fast. She still wore the bracelet with the little gold footballs on it, counting the gridiron Hail Marys of her life with Vin. Two from Fordham, two from St. Cecilia, two from Army, six from Green Bay. When the lights dimmed, his words still shone on the side wall, the biblical passage from Corinthians. Run to win. In her single-mindedness, Marie was like the coach during football season when life was a distraction from the game. Now to her, it often seemed that anything but Vince Lombardi was a distraction. When a friend asked if she ever thought of remarrying, she said only if she could find a man who wouldn't mind staying up until 2 in the morning, listening to her talk about Lombardi. She continued rehearsing the speech. Everybody knows about all those marvelous records that Jimmy Taylor made in Green Bay, especially those 5 magnificent years when he gained 1,000 yards. But I suspect that tonight, this weekend, this honor will be the thing he will take most pride in because, you see, he is the first person of the great Packer players of what is popularly known as the Lombardi era to be enshrined in this great hall. And there's something about being enshrined, it's like being crowned or canonized, that is truly awesome. And I go up to the Hall of Fame and I cry. It occurs to me that the era of the 60s was professional football's finest hour. And I think the Packer players of the 60s dominated professional football at its finest hour. Marie still watched pro football well past its finest hour. She even took Vincent and Susan to a game at RFK a week after the funeral. Then, for a time, she became furious at the game that had consumed Lombardi. But she came back, and now she never missed a Sunday, watching all day long, 2 sets going at once, rooting for old Packers whenever they played. When the games were over, she retreated back into her dream world, looking at the scrapbooks and listening to his voice on tape. Things have changed, she would say. There's no one like Vince saying those things today. And she would bring out the tape of Lombardi's own induction into the hall, with young Vincent saying that his mother, more than any other, was responsible for the success that his father had, and Wel Mara saying that Vince Lombardi did not invent professional football, and he did not found the NFL. But he embellished them both to a degree never surpassed and seldom, if ever, equaled. And then the tape of Richard Nixon, at the Knights of Columbus convention at the Waldorf Astoria, saying that he called Lombardi days before he died and said, "Coach, you've had millions of people rooting for your teams, but there have never been so many rooting for you as there are tonight." Then she would listen to the voice of Howard Cosell, narrating Lombardi's biography on the night of his funeral. Vincent Thomas Lombardi, born 1913. Principal occupation, football coach. Her favorite tapes were of Lombardi himself talking to his players and to business conventions. She memorized his speeches about pride, country, freedom, and discipline, quoting him verbatim, incessantly, to the hairdresser Joanne, who made house calls at the condo to give her a perm, to the attendants in the basement garage who parked and delivered her silver Lincoln Continental, to her daughter Susan, who lived nearby and would visit with her three children, to friends from Green Bay and New Jersey, who stopped by during their winters in Florida. When not quoting Lombardi, she lionized him. It was her mission, she said, to protect his image. She said that he was bigger than life, that she was the envy of everyone who knew him, that she would walk behind him in airports and people would stare at him, but he never saw it. He was so terribly shy. That he was the symbol of everything this country once stood for and was now losing, that he would never die. And one more thing, something she inserted into the final draft of her Hall of Fame speech for Jimmy Taylor. She said it right near the end. "And we have a need in our country today for heroes. We don't have any heroes." When her son Vincent visited and heard her talk about the old man that way, it perplexed him. Yes, his father was an extraordinary coach, amazing in many ways, inspiring and heroic. But he was also all too human. Couldn't she remember what it was really like? "Come on, mother," he would say. "I was there." Marie Lombardi died of lung cancer in 1982. She was 67. Bart Starr, Forrest Gregg, Ray Nitschke, Herb Adderley, Willie Davis, Jim Ringo, Paul Hornung, and Willie Wood joined Lombardi and Taylor in the Hall of Fame. Great stars that knew their days in fame's bright sun, I hear them tramping to oblivion. Not the Green Bay Packers, perhaps, and certainly not the old man himself. There are no roadside markers pointing to his childhood home in Sheepshead Bay, nor to his gravesite at Mount Olivet in New Jersey. He is buried next to Marie and Maddie and Harry, in a modest plot on the back edge of the cemetery, his gray tombstone softened by shrubs on a gentle slope a few steps from a gravel road. Men from the Knights of Columbus attend to the grave, clearing away ice in winter and weeds in summer, and there are often a few weather-worn tokens of worship left behind. Seashells with shiny pennies in them, miniature statues of the saints, a green and gold plastic helmet, a felt Packers flag. The remnants of Lombardi's world are fading, yet his legend only grows in memory. The rugged and noble face, commanding voice, flashing teeth, primordial passion, unmatched commitment. In the end, it is perhaps Vincent who had been there, who gave him the highest honor. After years of working through the contradictory feelings that he had for his father, the son found his calling. He became a motivational speaker, using for his inspirational material the life and words of Vince Lombardi.
The End. You've been listening to When Pride Still Mattered by David Marinus. Narrated by Richard M. Davidson. Thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.